Hi, and welcome to Watch Next, the podcast where we recommend what you should watch next. I'm Dr. Ruby Sánchez Lozoya. Each episode, join me in a conversation with fascinating scholars and thinkers to explore world cinema in a way that feels warm, inviting, and completely jargon-free. Today, Professor Eleni Pallas and I try to figure out LSD2 together. Eleni Pallas is an Associate Professor of English and Cinema Studies at the University of Tennessee. She's the author of the book Classical Projections, The Practice and Politics of Film Quotation. Since we will be discussing the film in detail throughout the episode, consider this your spoiler reminder. And with that, let's begin. Welcome to the show, Eleni.
Thank you.
How are you doing? Excited for a weekend?
Very well. Oh, very excited.
We want to introduce our guests by talking a little bit about their likes and dislikes and how we ended up at LSD2. It was very interesting to find a film for you because we went a little bit back and forth. You're an expert in many things. And part of what we want to discuss, one option was Save the Green Planet because you were interested in Bougonia.
Right, right.
And also as an expert in the remake and the remix, it was interesting to talk about an adaptation, the change from a South Korean film to an American film.
Yeah, well, yeah, sort of. I think it's interesting to think about Yorgos Lanthimos as like this crossover Greek filmmaker who's now like, a big figure in Hollywood.
Yeah, a big Hollywood director. You are very interested in genre. Mm-hmm. You're teaching a class in the noir right now. Mm-hmm. And we were thinking about of different noirs to suggest to you. The list got a little too long because there is such a huge variety of the noir. And then we also were talking about the interest for your second project or things that are being interesting to you now lately about what's happening on right now in terms of like media studies, film studies, when they're speaking or they're in conversation with each other. Mm-hmm. And that's where we ended up being with LSD2.
Yeah. And I do just want to compliment you as we were like trying to narrow it down. You did pick a film that is so overwhelming. It's like three different films in one. And even then, it's like media upon media upon media and all the referentiality of it that like, yeah, if my problem was a problem of picking, you were like, so there, here's a film that's like 10 different things. That was great.
I mean, that's a good way of putting it. So then first thoughts, do you like it? Do you not like it? Overwhelming feeling. That's also how I felt when I watched it the first time.
100%. It felt like overload in both, I think in a productive way, but it wasn't pleasant. It felt, and in a way, I'm really glad to talk to you about it because sure, I can bring an interest in media and mediation and remix and referentiality, but I felt I was missing so much context. Even in the subtitles, there is, you know, the dialogue would be subtitled, but then there'd be on screen flashing and it would be there for a second and then gone. And I felt as though I was missing a lot that I want a scholar of Indian cinema to like slow it down for me and be like, here's what you're missing, you know?
Yeah, no, but I think that even someone who is familiar with Indian cinema, it was incredibly overwhelming. And I think it's by design.
Like, that's validating.
No, but for real, like the first 10 minutes is just so much going on. Like you were saying, there's flashing things, then there's like headers and banners, and then there's mixing. And then you also do not know, like, what am I watching? Because LSD2 opens with a very dramatic music and a helicopter is coming down, where like basically who, what, when, why, okay.
Right.
And it's replicating the style of reality TV shows. And it's like, oh, okay, this is a little bit like Big Brother, I get it. Mm-hmm. But they really do throw you in the deep end, like right away.
Yes, yes, it really. And I think part of the context of having streamed it almost, I wonder if it got a theatrical release and what that was like, because there was something about streaming it on my computer where the worry was, did I come in partway through?
Yes.
Am I supposed to be here right now? Where? So I thought that was an interesting sort of extra textual layer of coming in medias res, like to the max.
Yes. Do you watch a lot of reality TV or do you like reality TV?
I mean, I don't want to out you on your podcast, but I watched Traitors because of you.
Oh, yes.
And I was obsessed. Yes.
Yes.
If
they do a third one, this is why I'm going to watch that movie.
Oh, gosh.
And I mean, to go back to the ones that they use in the film, they start with Big Brother, which I also never watched. And then they have the dance shows. And it's a combination of, it's not a real dance show, but it is like America's Got Talent or Do You Think You Can Dance? But also a very interesting juxtaposition with like a truth show, right?
Right, right.
So either you say the truth or like, it's like truth or dare, but it's truth or dance. And from the beginning, you're like learning the rules of the show as you're watching it for the first time. Right. And then it has the component of the Big Brother because you can see them when they're not dancing in the house living together. And then what I thought it was very interesting is this off-cam, on-cam experience.
Yes. And I loved the way there was a sequence maybe in the middle of the first section where Noor has this like face-off with her mother that gets heated, but it's off cam. So then we see them repeatedly do it on cam until it's sort of dramatic enough to get aired.
So just to remind our listeners, the film is LSD2, which is a 2024 Hindi language sequel to the 2010 film directed by Divakar Banerjee, which was called LSD, also Love, Sex, or Dhoka. The film uses found footage and screen life formats like news channels, reality TV shows, and social media to explore truth and authenticity in a society full of screens. And it really feels like such an overwhelming experience, but also you feel a little bit guilty, or at least I felt when I was watching it, that I recognized everything. I was like, oh, this is Big Brother. Oh, this is the dancing competitions. Oh, this is TikTok. Like if you didn't know the shows, you would be like, oh, I have no idea what this is, but I do know.
Right. So maybe it's a warning sign if this film feels too recognizable to you. But I totally agree. And I do think it's a film, as we were thinking about, like, okay, right, choosing this film and what other films feel related aesthetically. It's just, I feel like this is one of the first films I've seen that is translating the online experience. It captured the feeling of each of these forms in a way that sometimes films about reality TV or films about online culture feel like they're made by kind of middle-aged film people talking about the internet. I don't know. Maybe that's shade unnecessarily at other films, but I thought it just did a nice job capturing online culture.
I think so too. And I do wonder how it was possible because he is a middle-aged man.
Really?
He is. But it's, I feel like, a very Gen Z movie. I think even the third one, which is when we're switched to Twitch or streaming, like gaming platforms, it still felt very authentic. Like it still felt like, oh yeah, when I watch a Twitch stream, it looks like this. Because the humor also kind of was translated. The sense of like this, you have your video stream and then you have these memes or these sounds that like are put in between. And I'm like, yeah, that is where I'm old and this is less recognizable, you know?
Right.
But nonetheless, it's like, oh yeah, I kind of see it.
Yes. Yeah.
I really, really enjoyed this film because it is so overwhelming. And my experience of watching it was I would pause it maybe every 5 to 10 minutes just to kind of like parse it down. And did you notice that thing? And they had this thing, like especially the news one. It's such a headache. It's so overwhelming. The news is going and then there's a banner underneath. Something is being said. And then you have the advertisements of a TV show. And then of a, like it's one is a sitcom of like a romantic couple. And then the other side is like a woman with a gun. And then the news changes. It's so jarring. Yes. It's so much.
Yes.
But it looks exactly like Indian news. So it's like, it was so well done.
Yeah.
And that was already very interesting to me. Yeah. And then this idea of like, oh, this is the news and this is how we consume media and this is, and how does affect our understanding of the truth? I thought that was like such a brilliant film. And that's why I was very interested to talk to you about it. How was your experience of watching the film?
I mean, I'm validated again to hear you say that you would stop it because I feel like I try not when I'm streaming things to replicate the sort of theatrical experience, but like just take the duration of the thing in, take, but I really felt like the impulse to stop, to take notes, write things down, or I did a little sneaky little Google, you know. I think the other thing that was in my mind as the three sections progressed were the ways that there was crossover between sections.
Yes, yes.
That to me felt a little bit like a puzzle film, one of these sort of ones that necessitate reviewing, because like the school shooting, right, happens in each one. So you have a sense that these are overlapping storylines, or, you know, we sort of see the couple from the second section in the first section, you know, but then, so I was just wondering how much audience interaction or engagement as a viewer does this film demand of us? Does it welcome of us? And then how much is it sort of pushing that back, as you're saying, because there's so much going on at any one moment that it's not as though it welcomes us into this world with a very sort of classical Hollywood cookie cutter kind of, you know, beginning, middle, and end.
You watched it as a streaming movie, right? It did. It was mostly a streaming movie.
Interesting.
And it actually is, in my opinion, not as popular and not as well-received or critically engaged with as it should, because I think it's a fascinating film. And Deepak Banerjee himself makes this kind of films that I would say they're ahead of its time. And then they're recognized later. But a lot of people would watch it on their phones.
Oh, wow.
So that, to me, is crazy.
Yeah.
Because it would be like the other layer of it, of watching it on your phone while you're getting notifications, getting bored, switching back and forth like they do in the film.
Yeah.
About a film about exactly this way of consuming media through so many layers.
That is so metatextual or meta-cinematic. And now, see, what you're saying now makes me want to go back and watch for changes in aspect ratio. And I wasn't paying attention. But there are moments, aren't there, where it goes horizontal and then it's sort of widescreen. This is an audio format that we're in. You can't see my hands doing the, but that's the idea, right? The sort of iPhone screen held up vertical versus horizontal with the black bars on the top and bottom.
That's actually such a good thing, right? That's great. Yeah. I want to go watch it on my phone horizontally. And then what happens when they, because you're absolutely right, they do change sometimes to have the black bars to look at like an Instagram thing. Is it just going to look very skinny? Oh, that's very interesting.
Right, right.
One of the questions he's asking is how we watch.
Yeah.
What we watch right now.
Yes.
Overall, a good experience other than overwhelming?
Yes, 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 yes. Oh, definitely, definitely. It feels good to to leave a viewing experience with maybe more questions than answers or with plenty to Google without a clear, I think I left the screening of it being like, what did I just see?
Yes. Yes.
What was that?
Yes. And I think that's actually very on par with most people that have shown this movie. It's this feeling of what did I just see? Which is, I think, is very rare nowadays. It's a very memorable film because of
it. Yes. Yes. And I've seen other if not like omnibus films where it's like, you know, sort of different sections feel really different either by different makers or the sort of like triptych, you know, Kinds of Kindness was sort of a triptych like that too by the same director. But it felt very different formally, generically. Yeah, it doesn't cohere. It's hard, you know, as you were saying, sort of like, what does this remind you of or what else comes up with this? It didn't call back to other films.
I mean, it's interesting that you're saying this because I like this omnibus film as a way of thinking about it. Perhaps it's a stretch. I'm going to say it and probably regret it, but
Go for it.
Is it remind you of Citizen Kane?
Okay, in what way? Give me more. What do you got?
I mean, okay, I already regret this.
No, I love it. I think that's great.
It's a puzzle film, like you said. Citizen Kane did this as well, right? There is something to be understood. Everything is fragmented. Everything is through the story of somebody else.
Yeah.
And you're piecing it together. Here, the narrative is fragmented by default because it's three unrelated shorts, share, download, and live. It did remind me of if we're thinking of what are the things that film does as a medium, it is one of these questions of incorporating new technologies to assess ourselves or think about ourselves. And Citizen Kane did this at his time, and it was huge at his time. I think it is a serious question or re-examination of this. What is the medium of film doing for us right now? Or what can it do?
I actually like that. It's perverse, but in a really fun way, I think, to think about, like, okay, if there's a kind of spectrum or a through line in, like, world cinema that is always meta-cinematic or interrogating the role of mediation in history and politics in, like, personal identity. Like, yeah, Citizen Kane starts with a newsreel. You're thrown right in the middle of it, right? And that does feel very related to the sort of, you're thrown in the middle of this reality television show and what's happening and who are these people? And then, yeah, they're asking similar questions in very different contexts to say, like, how does mediation, media, self-presentation or public perception or personal identity or, yeah, political power, right? How does that cohere when it comes to image making and controlling various forms of media? I think that works both for the newspaper industry in the 40s and in, you know, sort of online social media cultures in the 2020s.
And you call it perverse. I'm wondering why. But also, I think it relates to the point we started to make about the POV shots and the on-cam and off-cam.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about why you call it perverse first?
Well, because it's so formally, like, I mean, I just kind of love it, right? Because it's the idea that, like, Citizen Kane coming from, certainly, like, you and I both have taught intro to cinema, right? The sort of, like, intro class where classically the syllabi that I inherited and, you know, the sort of prevailing wisdom in American film studies often had placed Citizen Kane at the center, for better or for worse. I think it teaches really well, but it's also, you know, it's become a sort of stereotype of the center of American film canon, right? It's been the top of the AFI forever, the AFI best of list or whatever. So it feels fun to take a contemporary movie and be like, no, this is doing that too, you know, like to sort of open what feels like a very sort of dusty kind of set canon, you know? I like it.
You know, because you said it very nicely, I do think of them. I do like thinking about them, not as a spectrum, but rather as in conversation with each other.
Yeah.
Not as like a remake of Citizen Kane, which it clearly is not, but as a filmmaker who's very well read, very educated, who would be interested in seeing his film in conversation with films like Citizen Kane, but also like Rashomon. Because Rashomon also has this kind of unreliable narrator structure. It's not linear.
It's three parts.
And Rashomon and Citizen Kane and LSD2 are interested in the truth.
Yes, definitely. 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 And none reaches it, right? Even with the Citizen Kane reveal, you know, it's always like that's the MacGuffin through the whole thing, right? That doesn't really prove anything, you know, that.
Remind us, what's a MacGuffin real quick?
It's the catch-all word for the object, doesn't matter what it is, that sort of drives the narrative forward motion of a film. So it's the Lost Ark in Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's the Maltese Falcon. It's the suitcase in Pulp Fiction. It's the whatever, the Infinity Stones for my students, right? It's whatever we're going after. Uh-huh. Doesn't matter what it is.
And that's what you're saying. Yeah, sorry, because I interrupted you. It's saying that is, even if when the reveal happens, we still do not know what the truth is.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So Citizen Kane sort of dangles that for us with Rosebud to be like, okay, they never find out, but we do. But what does that prove? Versus this film, I don't know. Where do we end, Ruby? I mean, I feel like that's my question for you. It's like, can you explain the ending of this film to me?
Well, I think you got it, which is like, it doesn't matter because it's unsatisfying. So like towards the end of the film, we have gone through the first, we have three stories. Yeah, so we have the story of Noor in the first one. We have the story of Kulu in the second one. And we have the story of Game Puppy in the third one. And they're related, as you were saying before, because there are glimpses of all the stories in every segment. And towards the end segment, which is Download. When we're following Game Puppy, who is a Twitch streamer, basically, the equivalent of a gaming streamer who gets basically hacked, not necessarily blackmailed, but there is a fake video of him going around in the internet, and that threatens his reputation, soils his reputation or his image, and it's basically not him. And the question is how did this video were made? So again, at the question of truth and authenticity. And towards the end of the film, what happens is that it is revealed that it is the algorithm that is the one tricking him and making these videos. So when he goes to this website, which is very 90s beginning of the internet website, he puts on the metaverse headset.
So this like VR.
Yeah, the VR headset.
Yeah.
A nice juxtaposition of beginning of the internet and latest thing of the internet. And he gets basically absorbed into the metaverse.
Right.
And then there's a news reporter who also goes and interviews him in the metaverse. And then my reading of it is he becomes this guru. That the thing is that he tells people is, I am happy this is true. The question of the truth is very important. Yeah. You are happy in a place that is not real. It's fascinating. But also what we have learned is that, it is the reveal that it is the algorithm who's doing all these fake videos, which is not very interesting. It is also revealed that it was not him who killed the kid. In the Instagram feed of the girlfriend who was perhaps not a real girlfriend either, it was the social media girlfriend.
Right.
She says, oh, yeah, they arrested the driver. And again, when I watched it, it's like, I don't even know if he actually did this because we heard so little information.
Right.
And it doesn't even matter because at least he's the fall guy of this. Was he the killer or not? Who knows? And the thing is this, we were going to move on with the story, right? We move on in the film without questioning this at all. So I think you're absolutely right that the truth doesn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. We end on the sort of ecstasy of the virtual reality, right? It's like this, the moment of sort of like ascendancy of Game Poppy, who now has like a different name.
I think that's very on par with the movie. And I think it is one that does make you feel this way, but also does make you want to rewatch and kind of figure it out.
Yeah.
I think for a film that is so interested in the contemporary moment of how we are mediated by screens, how we're always in front of a camera, we're always in front of a screen.
Yeah.
You would think that cameras or web cameras were supposed to reveal the truth, right? Yeah. They're proof. This is real. Yeah. It's a capturing a real moment. Yeah. And it's good for solving crimes. It's good for like evidence. And yet it feels like everything is fake.
Yeah, so it works with the progression of the three sections, right? Say, okay, reality television. And there's a sense that that is the most, we've been living with that format for a long time. So like bringing us in with a commentary about how that reality, quote unquote, is constructed.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Then we go to the second section that is sort of about evidence and crime, as you're saying, the way that this sexual assault, but also the reveal of sex work is incredibly mediated, right? Like Zoom interviews and then just even like the opening, which I found really difficult, right? Just the sort of having a phone recording in someone's face after having been assaulted. There's a lot to say about that, but that sort of is interrogating the role of the image in the sort of prosecutorial or, you know, evidence-seeking project. So by the time we get to the third one, the third section, to end it in this, you know, extravagant like AI sequence and then the animation of the virtual reality feels like not even like a linear sort of like, you know, we start here interrogating reality and then it's heightened and then it's heightened again, that it feels like a sort of ecstatic, just like to the nth degree, an explosion of the idea that cameras reveal truth. Maybe.
Did you think that like the metaverse looked pretty?
No. Is that bad?
No, I think it's ugly.
Yeah, no, I didn't like it. No.
It was very like, not pixelated, but very amateurish, very underwhelming.
Yes. I mean, especially in the age of the like James Cameron Avatar, this sort of a kind of celebration of the CGI form that just feels like kind of ecstatic and hyper aesthetic, it in a way was grounding to see it pixely and feeling dated, and that it was, it heightened for me an awareness of its constructedness,
mm-hmm.
because it didn't look quote unquote good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that there's something about watching Avatar and being like, wow, you know, this is a feat of aesthetic manipulation via computer. That we're sort of not, we're blocked from that aesthetic contemplation. And we're just like, oh yeah, these are like, you know, this is digital, this is code.
I think actually you're right, because it could have looked better. The expectations, at least the expectations of everybody, was like, go join the metaverse. It's going to be great. It didn't remind me of Avatar, but I think you're absolutely right, because there are examples both in Hollywood and in Indian cinema of excellent CGI, of beautiful images created through CGI. And these were definitely not it.
Right.
They were, like you said, they were dated. They look like The Sims.
And it did.
And it's like, this is like computer animation, CD-ROMs, you know? It's very, very underwhelming.
Yes.
And I've heard this before too. It's like, oh, when you are, especially with VR headsets, you're like, oh, wow, I have hands. But you know, also when you're alive, you also have hands, right? Like, why is this the bar? And the bar is actually on the floor.
Yeah.
And also, it's one that is very mediated by sponsors. The sunset brought to you by so and so. It just felt incredibly underwhelming. And I think it's, that was, to me, is, I read it as something that by design, right? Oh, we are escaping reality into in a second reality, like Second Life, for all of these VR experiences. And they are nowhere near to reality. Yeah. Leave alone the messiness of the everyday life. And the fact that you get sunshine for free. but that it relies on the idea that you have to tell yourself that this lie is a truth. I'm happy, this is the truth.
Mm.
Which I'm also of two ways or two minds about it, because at the end of the day, yeah, okay, we're in this quote-unquote pristine water or whatever, and this guy can fly. He's always flying, which apparently is what sells people in Second Life. It's the being this much above the ground. Climb a tree, sorry. But that at the end of the day, what we want is this moment of happiness. And I think more than anything else, somebody telling us what to feel or what to think and what is real.
Yeah, yeah. And as you say, if the standards for CGI or digital animation, also so much of Hollywood digital animation is outsourced.
Yeah.
To places like India too. So like just thinking about like the sort of geopolitical economies of, you know, creating digital imagery. But as you said, like it does look like Sims, which certainly for our generation was the first time, at least I don't know, I'll speak for myself.
No,
right?
No, no, I'm with you.
As a 35-year-old lady, right? Like Sims was the first time that I was creating a digital avatar, making it look like myself and then trapping it in a house and lighting it on fire, which is something we should interrogate in therapy probably. But like, you know, thinking about the ways that for a generation of young people, Sims is the first exercise in self-representation in a kind of virtual reality.
Yes. And yeah.
So taking up that aesthetics is interesting. That's all.
No, And like you said, with like setting on a fire, right? We also, in contrast to this place, that we always sell this idea of the digital utopias. What do we do when we get The Sims? The first thing is we make a pool, put the Sim in the pool, and then remove
the ladder. Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm glad it's not just me and my homicidal tendencies.
That's, I don't know. Because it was the only way of, you know, anyway.
But anyways, regardless of how much we killed our Sims, is the idea that to appropriate that aesthetic does, I think, activate something about the future that we were promised through games like Sims, you know, to be like, okay, how are we imagining a future? And I like that. Some of the most interesting science fiction films, too, imagine a future through like aesthetics of the past. Or aesthetics of the past that were imagining a future that didn't materialize.
Oh, that's interesting. Do you have an example in mind?
Gattaca. It's got all these sort of mid-century vibes to the, you know, people that are, you know, driving their electric cars, but they're sort of mid-century looking. But also, in my film noir class from last year, we watched Blade Runner, right? And that's imagining a future through the look of, you know, classical noir from like the 30s and 40s, right? So, or, you know, through the 1940s. But I would say especially the first one is imagining the future through a very noir lens. So it's imagining a future by appropriating some of the aesthetics of the past.
Actually, that's a very interesting point. The film is appropriating the aesthetics of the past with the Sims look of the metaverse, right? This putting in contrast how the metaverse actually looks like, which is looks like a cheap animation, in being made by the most expensive, the most cutting edge technology. Right. And we also have very ugly fake pictures of people with AI and deepfakes.
Yeah. And this is something I wanted to ask you, because of course I was getting the references from an American context. So when it's Elvis, when it's Marilyn Monroe, I was wondering...
When it's Hitler.
Yeah, and Hitler, you know, but almost Charlie Chaplin Hitler, right?
Yes,
it looked like
yes.
this. So it was sort of, again, like mediated through American media. And I was wondering whether those are just the references that I'm getting as an American audience member, or is it also a commentary on how much American media has like colonized the global image? I wondered how that might read to an audience member not situated in American culture.
I think you're spot on that. It's just because so much of the reference in the world is the West, Hollywood mostly. It's actually an interesting way of thinking about it, right? You're replicating the canon because in that sense. Because all your film, all your references are coming from Hollywood inadvertently, because it's what is mostly available. That's just going to get replicated.
Yeah. Which opens up much bigger questions about like, what are we training AI on and what is it replicating? And, you know, all of the biases and, you know, isms, racism, sexism, you know, ableism, like all those things that are baked into our media. Then how does that get spit out again when it comes to generative AI? Were there any deepfakes that weren't? It was like Charlie Chaplin, Hitler.
Marilyn Monroe, Che Guevara, Elvis.
Che Guevara. Okay. Yeah. One.
And again, the Che Guevara is the poster Che Guevara.
Right.
It's not the real Che Guevara.
Right. Yeah. So hyper mediated.
Do you feel like Hollywood is embracing AI into the creation of images?
Well, if you ask the unions, you know, like that was the huge, one of the huge sticking points of the strike in 2023. But I think it's very much an open question, you know, all of the recent outrage about Tilly Norwood, who was marketed as the first AI actress, and everyone was all in a huff, and, you know, some healthy skepticism and, you know, outrage about that. But so I think it's very much an evolving conversation as AI evolves, as the, you know, Hollywood industries are continually consolidating and, you know, evolving, right? There's so much sort of movement there.
I think the film is interested in asking the question, like, is AI and deepfakes just part of the way that we use technology? Like, is it just part of a natural movement from photography to filmmaking to CGI to now AI? Or is it something that should be resisted or at the very least should be challenged or questioned? Because we have it, right? We have CGI. We have de-aging, right? In Hollywood.
No, definitely. I have been following a conversation that's people trying to resist the argument of inevitability. The idea that, you know, it's just coming for us and there's nothing we can do about it. Or, you know, I think it deserves much interrogation. And I think that's why this film feels important too, right? That it is raising those questions. I think I was interested in the way that gender and sexuality played out in all three pieces, but even just in the deepfake, like AI section, that so often, and I'll have to get statistics on this, because my sense is, though, that often deepfake and the sort of revenge porn industry targets women, which is not to say it doesn't target men too, but I just wonder how much I was interested in the fact that the sort of deepfake videos that cast the gamer as queer then sort of like offered a different story than one we often hear about revenge porn or sort of women being targeted online and the sort of like baked in just rampant misogyny on so much of the internet. What do you think? Is this, I was interested in that too, just because so much of AI, again, as I was saying before, sort of like replicates what it's fed, you know?
I think it's a very good question to bring everything together, because I think it tells us what is at stake. Images have been used to understand the world, what is true and what is not. Not only of what how we see other parts of the world that we will not have access to in that kind of legacy, but also because of how they have been implicated in things like the news that that the film is very interested in, but also as evidence that we've discussed, but there's a lot of crimes that are being reported, documented, decided upon based on this photographic evidence. So the film is not saying like, oh, is it bad that we just have ugly pictures? Like, do we have like a substandard metaverse? But it's like, no, this is at stake in the real world right now, but also in my reading of it, at least, a fundamental humanity existential question, like, can we trust? What can we trust? And what happens in a world post-truth? What happens in a world where we cannot trust?
The sort of photochemical guarantee that light bounced off of someone's face and was registered on a photochemically sensitive film strip, right? So it's like the reality of the light bouncing off of your face captured on the film camera is a sense that you were there at this moment and the light, you know, was registered in that way photochemically. So then to say, right, in the digital world, though, I think interrogating images and their meaning is happens even with film, of course. If I am set upon to sort of justify my own existence as a film scholar and as a film teacher, it's just how important media literacy is, you know, in so many different contexts, whether it's photochemical, you know, film on a film strip, or whether it's digital, or whether it's AI generated, to say having a thoughtful awareness and interrogative sort of critical thinking about images is crucial now more than ever. And I think this film helps make that visible too.
And I think talking about the film also helps with building media literacy. But also one of the things that is important is the community aspect of film watching that we have kind of lost because of streaming and watching individually compared to watching in the theater. But that we can have after the film, and when we come together and try to figure out because what happened, it's also very important.
Right. And that's my plea for in-person film screenings, for film classes, but then also podcasts like these, right? That if you don't have moments to watch and talk to people, that there are podcasts out there that you can listen to. It's important.
So I think that segues really well for our rapid-fire questions. Eleni, are you ready for your rapid fire questions?
So ready.
All right. Favorite movie snack?
Oh, popcorn. Always.
Excellent choice. Movie theater or streaming?
Oh, movie theater. 100%.
Trailers or no spoilers?
Trailers.
Movie you would like to see again for the first time?
So I was thinking about this. I think that I would want to watch The Watermelon Woman again for the first time.
Nice.
Yeah.
Movie you watch way too young?
Oh, gosh. My father had fond memories of watching the Fellini film Amarcord, and so he kept requesting it at the local sort of repertory theater, and they finally played it. And there's a couple scenes in there that watching them with my father was like, no, I'm scarred. I don't like it. No.
Oh my God.
I think he didn't remember that part. It was unfortunate for all of us. So
that's funny. One of your favorite movies?
Oh, gosh. almost anything classical Hollywood, I would say. I love Some Like It Hot. I can say all the dialogue. I just enjoy that one.
You know what? You're the second person in the podcast who said that.
Who said that before?
The professor before you, Deborah Beck. So, yes.
Nice. Should I plug a different film then? I can plug a different film.
No, it's up to you. It's nice to have a buddy, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, we'll stick together. I like it.
One film that is required watching or that you think everybody should watch?
Ooh.
Something that's always in your syllabus, maybe.
Something that's always on my syllabus. Illusions by Julie Dash.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Well, Eleni, thank you so much for coming to the podcast. It was
thank
a lot of fun.
Thank you for having me. It was so much fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Watch Next. A huge thanks to our guests for joining us today and to everyone at Lates and at UT Austin's College of Liberal Arts and the Department of Asian Studies for making this show possible. Make sure to subscribe so you never miss a conversation. Leave us a rating or a review to help other listeners discover the filmmakers and scholars we feature. New episodes drop every 2 weeks. Listen to Watch Next wherever you get your podcasts.